Welcome to the podcast. Today's Voices of Conservation Science from Montana State University in beautiful Bozeman, Montana. We're here in Studio 300 Lewis, and I'm Chris Guy, your host for today's podcast. This podcast focuses on people doing science that's then used to conserve natural resources. The podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Today's a very special day for me because I have a very, very special person that I'm going to be interviewing today. It happens to be the co-host of this podcast, Dr. Andrea Litt, and she is an associate professor at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. Andrea, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thanks for having me. Turning the tables, sitting in the other chair.
Yeah, you know, you did this, you interviewed me a few months ago, and it is a little different, right?
It definitely feels different sitting over here.
Yeah, and
I should have known turnabout was fair play.
Yeah, so I'm going to be nice to you like you were nice to me,
and
we'll have the standard kind of set of questions, and we'll elaborate on a few things here and there. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I guess we'll start from the beginning. I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin with my parents and two brothers. From there, we could go through the academic laundry list. I did my bachelor's in zoology at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Go Badgers.
Yes.
And I worked in a few different labs and in the field in Madison after that. And then I got the chance to do my master's. So I moved down to Florida to University of Florida in Gainesville. Go Gators. And I was in the Department of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation. And my project there was part of a larger project. And one of the collaborators there was a nature conservancy. And so after I finished my master's, I went to work on the larger project for the nature conservancy and did that for a couple of years on the panhandle of Florida. And then I bounced way west to Tucson to pursue my PhD at University of Arizona, Go Cats. And in this case, Wildcats, not Bobcats, to make the distinction. And did a PhD in wildlife and fisheries and a minor in statistics. Had some jobs after that, a postdoc, and my first faculty job in far south Texas at a satellite campus of Texas A&M, working for the Caesar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute.
That's a mouthful.
And then I got the distinct privilege to come here to Bozeman to the Department of Ecology at Montana State. And I got here in 2011. So 8.5 years later, somehow the time has flown.
Yeah.
And here we are today.
Yeah, that's quite a trajectory there, bouncing
more introduction than maybe you wanted.
No, that's awesome. I was curious about the PhD, and you had a minor in statistics. What drove you to do that?
Well, at the time, I was taking a bunch of statistics classes and realizing I really enjoyed it. I taught a biostatistics class. My advisor was very quantitative, and I taught for him while he was on sabbatical and while his co-instructor was on sabbatical, so two different times. And I realized I liked it and that it was interesting to me, and I liked learning more about it, and I realized it could be a really important set of tools in my back pocket moving mm-hmm. forward. Our field is getting more and more quantitative, and it just seemed like if I could jump through all the hoops, seemed like a sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
It was a little painful, but definitely was a good move in terms of securing employment and having opportunities after that.
Yeah. And it makes you very popular too, right?
Which is both a blessing and a curse, right?
Yeah.
You have to keep it on the down low that you know some things. And
because everybody needs some help with statistics.
Me too.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah, it's just listening to you talk about how you moved around, and, you know, I was kind of joking about it, but what the really cool thing is all the nuggets you picked up at those different institutions and working for the Nature Conservancy and NGO, and just, you know, the breadth of understanding, you know, I guess in a way what you liked and didn't like at those different institutions and working for those different entities.
Yeah, looking back, let's see. I mean, I really feel like I had a lot of great opportunities placed in front of me. And so I think more about those strengths of like the, yeah, like the, mm-hmm. the experiences that it gave me and the skills that it gave me. I think each time, you know, the downside is that the opportunity was temporary, right? So I had to move on.
Right.
The job I had with the Nature Conservancy was interesting because it wasn't a typical position with that organization, because we were doing a research project, and so there weren't too many field-based research projects that they were doing, and there was a whole host of us working for them, and so that was a really interesting and unique experience, and I didn't think I would get a chance to do that exact same thing again. So that was maybe one downside of that. I had a job where I did a couple jobs where I did a bunch of lab work, and I realized that lab work wasn't for me, but I had a field job where we were collecting data on double crested cormorants, and we would go out to these nesting colonies, and I absolutely loved the disgustingness of it all. Like, we would get up and we'd go out in the middle of the night, and it was dirty and stinky, and I just absolutely loved that. So it's funny. I liked some weird things about those experiences. Yeah. And each time, I just sort of had to move on. And so I didn't really have the chance to stick around and see how it might've played out.
So thinking back, I mean, you were just talking about some of the experiences that you really enjoyed, and thinking back, what compelled you to get in this career of conservation, or can you, you know, think about why did you like, you know, being in that bird colony and those kinds of things, and just, you know, what got you going?
Well, you know, in thinking about this podcast and thinking about the conversation we were likely to have, I look back and the path that I took now seems much straighter than it felt like at the time. I felt at the time I was like sort of bumbling along from experience to experience, not really knowing what I was doing or what the possibilities were. So growing up, I was the kid running around outside and collecting salamanders and catching fireflies and putting caterpillars in jars and waiting for them to metamorphose. And I was climbing trees, and we hiked and camped and biked and canoed when I was a kid. That was what the vacations were like. So I was liked that, but I didn't really have any sense that that was a career for a really long time. and I knew I liked science, and I knew I liked biology, but,
And part of it is that you're not thinking about a career at that age either.
No,
right?
But even I thought chemistry was amazing.
Yeah.
And I thought that in middle school too, because I had a couple of teachers that were crazy and they would blow things up. And I thought, wow, that was really fascinating. But, you know, I went off to college and I knew I was going to major in biology, but I thought I was going to like end up working in a lab, or I was going to be a park ranger or a work in a zoo. And really, yeah. I was pretty clueless. So it took me a long time to figure out that it was a career. And sometimes I look back and kind of am a little bit dumbfounded that I figured it out at all, because I wasn't good at asking questions of mentors or of faculty, or I don't know what my problem was.
Yeah, but you know, just it's kind of interesting listening to you. You talk about that, because you know the things that you did, collecting, you know, bugs and salamanders and putting them in a jar, climbing trees and all those kinds of things, being outside. How many folks have you interviewed for this podcast and you hear that same thing?
Absolutely.
Isn't that cool?
Absolutely. It's really cool. Yeah. And again, you know, I had these a few things that, again, looking back, and you're like, well, of course, it's so obvious. You know, one thing, I had this experience in high school. I took a class from a teacher, Stu Hannum, and it was the first time he was teaching this environmental science class. And I loved school. I was nerdy like that. And I liked learning. And again, I really liked science. But what was fascinating to me about this class is he took us down to the Milwaukee River, which was not too far from my high school. And he got us out of the classroom and we collected data. We collected data on water quality, all these different metrics. Mm-hmm. We used Secchi disks and we collected water. I know, right?
Right.
For turbidity, to look at the cloudiness of the water. And we collected water samples to look for E. coli. And, you know, we just did all kinds of things. We looked at those things under the microscope. And it wasn't so much that particular science was fascinating to me. It was just that we were out collecting data in the field. And I loved that. And then I got the chance to, this was part of a much bigger program called Testing the Waters. And they, there was high school all along the river collecting data. And there's all these different influences of inputs of nutrients into the river all along the way. And they were actually using the data that the high schoolers collected to inform decisions that were being made on the ground about this river. So there were inputs of farming, and there were inputs in my area of, we had a big park there and there was tons of geese. And so there was all the inputs from the geese. And then as you get into Milwaukee, it's all channelized and there's more concrete and more industrial pollutants. And so I got to present our data to a bunch of decision makers. And that, you know, again, I look back now and I think that was such a fundamental experience for me. But at the time I just thought it was really cool.
Right. And just, you know, I'm sure you were seeing that you could make a difference by collecting data and presenting it to decision makers that, you know, there you could make a difference and that you wanted to pursue a career in this.
Yeah. And again, now I look back and I think of course that was this thread, the beginning of a very long thread that has been really important to me from thereafter. But I didn't have a light bulb moment at the time. It just came a lot later.
And you know, speaking about this podcast, I've interviewed several individuals and they've said kind of the same thing that you said, that they didn't know that there was a career in fish and wildlife management or conservation. And it seems like our profession could do a better job of advertising that this is indeed a career. I remember, you know, talking to high school advisors when I was looking for something to do and, you know, you can never get a job in conservation. They're too competitive. Don't even worry about it. And I was like, okay, whatever.
But, no one even said that to me. No one even said that.
So it just seems like, you know, we can do a better job that you can make this a career.
Yeah. And even in college, I was watching a bunch of researchers and listening to the kind of work that they did. And a lot of it was a really important science, but it was more, it was less applied. It was less help make decisions on the ground, but more expand our understanding about a topic. And that just didn't grab me the way this more applied help make decisions kind of science did.
And we'll get into that here in a little bit about your research program. But before we do, curious about who was instrumental in your pursuing this career in conservation. You mentioned this teacher, Stuart Hannum.
And he was huge.
And are there others?
Well, certainly my parents, because again, they had me out in it and they sort of, you know, kicked me out the door, like go play. And that was always important to them that we were spending time outside. And my dad was pretty involved in something like things like Ducks Unlimited. And so they were doing restoration projects. And so I saw that and saw that there was some importance there. So I would say they were probably the most important until we get to the academic mentors when I was really in the thick of things.
Yeah, and so that's a little bit different than our normal interviews is, you know, we talk about folks that got people interested in conservation, but there's also this academic component that you have. And so who was instrumental in kind of steering you towards this academic program and this minor in statistics?
Yeah. So obviously my advisors for each degree. So for my master's, that was George Tanner at University of Florida. And for my PhD, that was Bob Steitel at the University of Arizona. And they both helped me in really completely different ways. They're very different people and they gave me a whole different suite of things. But the common theme for both of them is that they could sort of see where I needed pushing and they would push me up to the edge of where I felt comfortable. And then they would give me a little more nudge and then I would do a little more and they'd give me another nudge. And then I had some really important committee members during both degrees that were really helpful. So Dick Franz at University of Florida, I was doing reptile and amphibian stuff and he was just a super gung-ho naturalist into those kinds of things. And I just found that absolutely fascinating, his curiosity throughout his whole career. During my PhD, Bill Motter and Guy McPherson also pushed me to think really hard about things. Mm-hmm. The statistics, I guess, had to come from Bob Steitel, and because he was quantitative, and I just saw that as a good challenge and an important set of skills.
Yeah, so thinking about this, what how did you know that when you were getting your bachelor's degree that you needed to go get a master's degree?
That's a good question. I think I just thought I wanted one.
Yeah.
and I thought I was interested. I had done some research as an undergrad, and I had seen that process through a little bit as an undergrad. And so I somehow, again, I have no idea how, figured out I needed a master's to do that. And at first, I was going to go work on sea turtles, but I couldn't sort of make that happen and didn't really get much of a reply from people that I had contacted. And so I got a chance to do it because George Tanner contacted me. My application must have come across his desk and he saw something in there. So he took a chance. And then go on from there.
And so when you were getting your bachelor's degree and you decided that I need to go get a master's, did you know at that time you wanted to go get a PhD then too?
No, absolutely not. I had said I was going to get a master's and that was that.
Yeah.
And for a long time after that, after I finished my master's, I said I wasn't going to get a PhD. I was going to keep doing jobs and work that I really enjoyed, and I wasn't going to get a PhD. And I was really lucky because when I was working for the Nature Conservancy after my master's, my boss, Louis Provencher, gave me a bunch of duties that he pushed me. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing work that was probably beyond what was in my job description.
Right.
But I got this little taste of research at that point. And so it wasn't until maybe a year and a half or almost 2 years later that I thought, oh, okay, maybe I should think about this PhD thing.
Yeah, so again, why was that? What flipped that switch? Why did you, because getting a PhD is not a trivial exercise.
No, it's, no, absolutely
it's,
not.
I don't know what your financial situation was at the time, but when you go back to graduate school, you're normally making a lot less money.
And I had been working
And so you'd started your career development, and sometimes people think going back to school could be kind of backwards. You got to think ahead beyond that, but just what triggered you?
So working with Louis had a PhD and he was leading this massive research project that my master's was a subset of, and he got to call the shots. He got to think about what the questions were going to be and how we were going to address them, how we were going to, he was going to design the study and how we were going to collect the data and then oversee all the data analysis and write the papers. And I realized that I wanted to be him. I wanted to have that job and not just follow the instructions and the plan that had already been laid out. And again, thankfully, Louis had given me a bunch of duties for data analysis and writing that wet my whistle there, I guess. But I realized that research was fascinating to me and I wanted to be the one asking the questions and making the decisions.
So academia wasn't really on the radar at that time.
It was not.
So, if you will, how did that evolve?
Yeah, I again thought I was going to do research. So I saw myself in a position where a lifelong position of research, whether that was a federal research scientist or something like that, or if there was another position like Louis, which there aren't a ton of them, that's what I saw. I had never taught. And so as a PhD student, I had the opportunity to teach multiple times as sabbatical replacements, as a TA, different classes, mammalogy and statistics. And I thought, oh, I kind of like this. And I also had the chance to mentor students as field technicians or in class or other times, other ways. And I realized the mentoring was really important to me and really something I enjoyed. And so then I started thinking about like what I was going to do later. Right. And I thought about the government or nonprofit route and actually applied and got offered a position with the Park Service. And I thought, well, if I'm going to try this academic thing, I better make it go at that first and then see how it works out. And there you go.
There you go.
It was the teaching that hooked me and the mentoring.
Yeah. So we've talked, how you got here, from your early childhood days and, your academics and all that. And, there are speed bumps along the way or hurdles we often ask our folks on the podcast.
Definitely.
Or would you be willing to share some of the hurdles that you had to get over to get to this point where you're sitting in the chair here being interviewed by me?
Sounding like I know what I'm talking about. Well, sure. I mean, definitely the some of the big ones was sort of figuring out the path and figuring out what the next steps were and figuring out what I wanted to be when I grew up, if I've reached that place. and that obviously it didn't feel as linear as I've described. And then figuring out the academic route on top of that. So once I figured out the ecology and wildlife thing, figuring out what the next steps were. And all along the way, it's sort of convincing myself that I am capable of those next challenges when people were pushing me. And whether that was learning the statistics or deciding I could get a faculty job or getting to tenure or those right. things, all those big monumental hurdles. And just always second guessing myself, which I think we all do. There's no handbook for right. any of this. Right. And so you're bumbling along and hoping that you don't muck it up too badly. Along the way, I've certainly wondered about how much gender plays in sort of feeling insecure about my place in this field. Mm-hmm. I had lots of male mentors, very few female mentors. I think along the way, I just convinced myself it was just totally normal and yeah. That everybody felt this way. And I think they probably do. But I've often been the only female and often the youngest person in the room. So you're never sure how much of it is age, people not taking you seriously right. because you're young or because you're female or both.
Right.
But a lot of that just plays into convincing yourself that you can do it.
And I think that's it. And it's interesting to think about this because, you know, obviously I haven't had the gender issue,
right.
but
right.
I have had the young and starting
new
out in this profession,
yep.
new professional, and you have kind of, man, can I do this? You know, maybe I don't have the skills to make
or what
this
do I know?
Or
compared,
what do I
yeah.
know? Yeah. But I think the thing, as you were mentioning that, I was reflecting on the mentor part of it. So you have these mentors, right? And your advisors. And we forget is they have, how am I trying to say this? They have confidence in us. And that confidence, we should take that and embrace that as support for, yes, we can do this.
Absolutely.
But we don't think of that because we're trying to always convince ourselves.
Yeah.
But a lot of times we don't think about the people that are our mentors. They wouldn't have us if they didn't think we could, if we couldn't do the job.
Right. And, right? and it's funny because when I look back and think about the things that really push me, I mean, I know that they were pushing me, mm-hmm. but the some of the times where I feel like I really was pushing, it was pushing back because somebody basically told me I couldn't do it.
Right.
And so those are the things that pop up, which is the craziest thing because the people that were supporting you were far more influential,
right.
but it's the negatives that sometimes are louder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. yeah. I had somebody tell me that they weren't convinced I could do the stat minor. And I just got grumpy about it. And I was like, yes, I can.
Good for you. Good for you.
But yeah, it's funny.
So I'm here with Dr. Andrea Litt, and she's an associate professor at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology and a co-host of this podcast. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about your research program, if you could, in a nutshell, because you have a lot going on. I know that because you're just down the hall from me here.
Right?
So you have a lot going on. So kind of tell us a little bit about, you know, what your focus is, if you will.
Yeah, we are working on a lot of different things, but I'd say the umbrella that holds it all together is that my students and I are trying to understand how different human activities affect wildlife populations and communities, so groups of different species, and then often trying to think about how we reduce any negative impacts that are possible. So in terms of the human impacts, I'm thinking about our human activities. I'm talking about things like non-native species, both non-native plants and non-native animals, and how those affect different species of wildlife. Thinking about changes in land use, so development and those kinds of things, or changes in disturbance. We've done work with wildfire, prescribed fire, and with things like beetle kill in forests, creating changes in the habitat conditions. So there's a lot of habitat threads that run through our work, mm-hmm. thinking about how our human activities affect habitat, which then in turn affects the wildlife. And we're really typically working closely with agencies because of that applied nature of things that I found out I liked a long time ago.
Right.
We've worked with some nonprofits, and we're trying to do work that fills some sort of information gap for those decision makers as they think about restoration or management or conservation activities. We've worked on a whole bunch of different taxa, which is which has been super fun, but it kind of goes back to my training. So my master's was on reptiles and amphibians, and then my PhD was on small mammals, like different species of rats and mice, and on arthropods. And I've continued working on those groups since, but now we've added things like bats and black bears and even some birds. So I've got a student working on turkeys that's been on this podcast, one that's working on sage grouse that's also been interviewed for this podcast, but still continuing with some of the other things like arthropods.
Yeah, so that's got to be challenging to stay up with the literature on those different taxa. I mean, I would think especially, given the state of amphibians and reptiles, that literature is probably rapidly changing. And so, I mean, you got your hands full.
I do. And that means I lean on my students a lot to think about some of the real species specific knowledge. But I think a lot of what makes it fun for me is that some of the questions, then we can see how things are the same or different when we look at different taxa. And it also means that we can pick the species or group of species that really helps us answer the overarching question the best. Where can we get the most data, the best data?
Right.
And it means, I'm a little bit on my toes of trying to keep my fingers in lots of pots, but it means a lot of collaboration with my students and with other biologists that really know their stuff.
And when you talk about your students, is this mostly graduate students, or do you have undergrads in your lab as well?
We have a mix. We definitely have a mix. When I first started, it was just graduate students, but we've been bringing in the last 5 or 6 years, been bringing in undergrads to help and having them work on a subset maybe or a side project under the umbrella of my grad students project. And then they get the opportunity to mentor the undergrad too. And it's been really rewarding to have that diversity in our lab group because we get together and we read papers and have conversations, and everybody's got something to add because they're all coming from different backgrounds. So that's been really fun.
Yeah, that's cool. And a lot of the research is centered around how to balance human use and, conserve wildlife, right?
Definitely. Yeah, we had a project working on a threatened species of frog in New Mexico in a place where water is really scarce. And so it was thinking about how far frogs can move on the landscape to make sure that there are water resources, and those might be human created water sources, so that the human needs of groundwater and of ranching and all these things could coexist as best as possible with this threatened species. So it's really pretty fun to think about hard issues, but how we don't necessarily always have to choose one or the other.
Right. What's kind of nice is, we can hand that over to the decision makers or policy makers.
It's true.
Those are the tough decisions.
Absolutely.
I talk to my colleagues with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and they're the ones that are making some really tough decisions.
Yeah. I mean, it is a little funny sometimes to think we help, quote unquote, inform decisions. You're like, well, we provide some information that then you're right. We hand off to those that really have to do the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mentioned the students and I'm, as you mentioned earlier, that's what really, when you first started doing some teaching, got you interested in this academic career. And what makes that so important to you, the teaching and the mentoring?
I think it's the watching the transformation of students and watching them grow and develop and really grasp a topic in class or really get excited about species that they never really thought about before, or with my grad students or the undergrads that are working on research projects, to watch them develop a set of skills or a level of confidence throughout the time we spend with them. It's so fun and so rewarding. Mentoring is definitely my favorite and best part of my job.
Yeah, it is.
We're so lucky.
We are. And it's just amazing to watch them transform. And especially when that, you know, I know it's cliche, but when the light bulb goes off
and then
they just take off and you're learning as much from them as you're teaching them.
Which is also makes it really rewarding too, is it's definitely not a one-way street. And then, you know, you know this really well too, is our students go on to have really interesting and important jobs and careers. We maybe get the privilege to work with them again
exactly.
and we get to go see them go do great things. And, and that's, you know, I hate that our jobs mean everybody has to leave,
right?
but if we're lucky, they're people that we get to work with on in other ways as well.
And going back to our decision-making conversation, you know, a lot of our students are the ones that are making those really difficult decisions.
Absolutely.
That have to deal with human use and conservation of species. And so they're really making those hard decisions for the next generations.
Yep, absolutely.
So what do you think has been your most important contribution to conservation to date?
You know, I really think it's the students. I think that's where you have the broadest impact, right? Like I can do a few research projects, but every one of those students goes on to then go do their own sets of research projects or do their own management decisions, or maybe train a whole host of other students, and it becomes this big forking tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, you know, as much as I'd like to say that my work has really made these big leaps and bounds in conservation, I think it really is more about the students and how they go on to have a legacy that far exceeds ours.
Yeah, I've thought of that too. And, you know, you think about the papers you write or the papers that the students write. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about this on this podcast and, you know, using this podcast as a forum to get more information out, because very few people except scientists are reading those journal
right.
articles, you know? And so, you know, my point is there, you can write that paper and you're going to touch a handful of individuals that are going to go use that information or cite it. But you think about your students going out and how many people they're touching, and then they're training folks.
Yeah. And again, that just makes that aspect of our jobs just even more rewarding.
So speaking of jobs, what do you think you're going to be doing in 15 years?
My goodness. I was thinking about this past, you know, this journey I've been on for, if I look 15 years back, there's no way I would have seen this place. So to think 15 years into the future, I mean, who knows, right? I mean,
yeah,
I never saw myself working on black bears 15 years ago. So much less, yeah, big, large things. I work on for a long time. I worked on the charismatic microfauna, I like to say, you know, it's all the things that maybe people were less excited about. I mean, I got pretty excited about rats and mice, honestly,
right.
You know, and they're pretty fascinating, but, I worked on lots of tiny things. And, so I just have no idea what's next. I'm really lucky. I'm going to get the chance to go down to Antarctica.
Ooh.
And, help on this large Weddell seal project that's been going on in this department. So, you know, maybe Weddell seals will be next. I don't know. And I never would have imagined that adventure being part of my story either. So who knows?
It's so hard to predict. I'm in the same boat. I, you know, would have never thought I'd be sitting here, you know,
doing a podcast.
That's for sure.
But that's what makes it so fun, is you just never know what the opportunities are going to be and what might present itself as a really interesting question or a
exactly.
really hard problem that you get to think hard about.
And you mentioned, just switching gears a little bit, charismatic microfauna. That was good.
Thanks.
And you also work on charismatic megafauna, and just, you know, I'm just reflecting when you said that on the difference between those two and what makes, you know, you know, we always joke with the in the fisheries world is that if you don't have, you know, brown eyes and fur, you can just scratch it off. Nobody cares. But just getting you to think about, you know, is what makes that difference? Do you know why that, why society sees it that way, or even professionals in conservation?
Well, I think some of it is there, many of those species are harder to see, to observe. And so people don't have any experience with them. And if you don't ever have any experience with them, then either you don't know how amazing they are, and you need somebody to shine a light on that. Or it seems you can make up all kinds of stories about how scary they are, like with snakes or, you know, slimy reptiles and amphibians, and reptiles aren't even slimy.
Right.
So you make up all kinds of stories about, or assumptions about these species. And if you don't see them and you don't know anything about them, and they're, you know, they're active at night, or they're active at dusk and dawn, and, or they're hard to see, like a lot of the small mammals, it's hard to relate.
Right. Right?
But these big bears or, right, or things, that, you know, people really, really want to work on. They uh-huh. say, oh, I'm going to be a wildlife biologist. I'm going to go work on wolves, or I'm right. going to go work on grizzly bears. You know, they've seen them on nature shows right. or something like that. And so I think it's when people shed a light on the cool adaptations that make a species really fascinating, or you find out about some role that they play that you didn't realize.
Yeah. And I think, you know, thinking about some of the nature shows that I see, is that every time you see a snake, it's doing something bad, right?
Right.
Yep. And, you know, most of the time you see a bear or something like that, it's cute with the cubs and everything. So there
even
is
though
some
that
stereotypical.
They're pretty darn dangerous.
Yeah, they are
too.
Very darn dangerous. Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting.
And you get farther away from humans, right? It's just, mm-hmm. we get outside of mammals.
Right.
And then it becomes a little more foreign
yep.
too, I suspect.
Yeah. Kind of starting to wind down here and thinking mm-hmm. about the last question. And we usually ask, what's your favorite plant and animal? And,
you're going to change it up on me.
I
aren't
might
you?
Change it up on you. I think I will. Your favorite scientist.
Yeah, that's tough. Well, I mean, it's tough to pick your favorite species,
right.
plant or animal. That's really tough too. But scientist is hard, I think, because it's hard to pick one. I mean, I feel like I have to have I need a team of scientists
right.
to be my favorites, right? Because I value different scientists for different reasons. I think one thing I really appreciate about certain scientists is their ability to communicate science in a way that relates to broadly to lots of people, not just to, they can communicate it to scientists in an important way, but they can also communicate to the public, maybe to bridge that gap that mm-hmm. we are talking about, getting people excited about species or things they don't know about. And so maybe some examples of that are people like E.O. Wilson, that's been able, has achieved a lot in his science career.
Right.
Studying ants, among other things, but then also has gone on to have this career where he's written a lot of books and given a lot of talks and presentations about science and bigger, broader issues that really can speak to non-scientists. Alda Leopold is another really important person in my development. He spent a lot of foundational time in Wisconsin. So being from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. his name and his legacy is sort of all over the place, including University of Wisconsin. A lot of people would call him the father of wildlife ecology. And so that seems like an important person to have as,
yeah.
as my favorite. But he also communicated science and natural history and observations about the natural world in a way that I think a lot of people could relate to. So that I've been thinking a lot about communication
right.
these days, particularly with the podcast. But then I also really appreciate people I actually get to work with as opposed to people that are big and famous right. or no longer alive,
yeah.
Like my previous examples. Another person I really appreciate is Dean Pearson, because that I've gotten to work with and written a paper with, because he's demonstrated really clear thinking, and he's done some very innovative thinking, and I appreciate that ability to look broadly. But I also am really fortunate to work with a lot of great scientists in this department, and mm-hmm. And so I take little nuggets from every person.
Yeah, I think that's just great advice, because I think by surrounding yourself with good people makes you better.
Yeah. Right? And watching you develop this class and this podcast, I mean, that again has gotten me really thinking about communication. And so you just take these nuggets from all different people. You have a whole portfolio of scientists you have in your pocket.
Yeah. And you know, it's just, we started this podcast because we're seeing a lot of, it's in the news, it's in the literature, that scientists aren't doing a good job of getting their science out there. And when somebody tells me I'm not doing a good job, kind of like you were, I get mad. And I'm like, okay, yeah,
watch me do it.
So hopefully this podcast is helping.
Can I give you my favorite animal?
Yeah,
though?
Knock yourself
because
out.
We were talking about this microfauna thing, and I just want to get people excited about a rodent.
A microfauna plug here.
My two very favorite animals of all times, the grasshopper mouse and the kangaroo. There's multiple species, but a kangaroo rat, and they're just amazing for totally different reasons. Grasshopper mice eat insects, and they howl at the moon, and they can eat things like they do. Look it up.
Can I see a YouTube video?
Oh, totally. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
And they can eat things like scorpions. They have an ability to process the venom in scorpions and basically use it as a pain reliever. So they block the channels that would make them feel pain. And then on the other side is kangaroo rats. These are both I studied them in the desert in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Kangaroo rats, they don't need to drink any water, and they get entirely all of their water from their foods that they hide in their underground burrows. So they'd eat seeds. Those seeds absorb humidity in their burrows, so they get water from that. And then they have these amazing noses that allow them to pull moisture out of the dry desert air.
You're making me feel bad putting a mouse trap in my garage.
Well, these are really charismatic mice and rats. Okay. You should Google grasshopper mice. And again, there's multiple species of that and kangaroo rats, multiple species of those guys.
I am going to do that. I want to see this howling at the moon.
They are pretty amazing.
All right. Well, Andrea, this has been a blast, and thank you for sharing your life with us today. And I'm looking forward to many more great podcasts hosted by you.
Yes. Thanks, Chris.
And if you enjoy the podcast, we'd like to hear from you. So please share a review or provide us a comment at todaysvoices@montana.edu. Thanks for listening to Today's Voices of Conservation Science, and please spread the word about this podcast.